Taylor Swift has dropped a 30-minute interview about songwriting with the New York Times. Welcome to my channel, or welcome back to my channel. My name is Zach. I am the Swiftologist. I make thoughtful weekly videos, and this week's video is an emergency video. I had no idea I was making it until this gorgeous day. This is basically everything I've been asking for years on end. It is interesting that we're getting this in the midst of the Life of a Showgirl album cycle, and notably in this New York Times interview section where they pull out the best five songs that they think represent Taylor's catalog, none of those are from the Life of a Showgirl. So that's interesting, but I am very excited to hear what Taylor has to say about her creative process. This is the thing that I love the most about Taylor and that I find most inspiring and what keeps me a fan from when I was, what, 10 or 11 years old until now, when I'm gonna turn 30 this year. That's crazy. It's Taylor's personal connection, her diaristic songwriting, her ability to make the personal universal. Those are the things that inspire me and have me doing my hand heart Tay Warrior behaviors. I can't wait, honestly, to dive into this. And it is a real treat and a gift. We don't get this very often. Not everybody in the article sat for a review. I'm shocked they could get Taylor on camera and not Lana Del Rey. But nevertheless, I am so grateful. And if you would like to hear more discussions about Taylor Swift songwriting and maybe the Life of Showgirl in particular, by the time you're watching this, my tour is starting in like 3 days in New York City, opening night. Opening night in New York City. We are very low on tickets. Meet and greets are sold out. You need to come and see us. We are so excited to talk all things Showgirl with you. We're also coming to Chicago, DC, Boston, Philly, Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver, LA, San Francisco, and Boston. We're out of meet and greets at most of the show, and we're on low ticket warnings for many others. So go to evolutionofsnake.com and get your tickets. We can't wait to see you. I'm not sure how the New York Times is going to go with the copyright of this interview itself. So if I have to dice it up significantly, don't worry. My full unedited reaction will be where it always is on the Patreon, patreon.com/Swiftologist. You can buy it as a one-off item, or you can sign up for the Swiftologist only tier. If you're not interested in my podcast, if you sign up to Swiftologist only, you'll get my reactions to pretty much everything that I react to. I don't put reactions on this channel anymore because the copyright stuff is too intense.
It's still such a mystery to me. I've been writing songs for so long, and I've started songs and finished songs so many different ways.
They've
gone through so many journeys. They've happened quickly. They've happened over time. They've been inspired by my life, by mythology, by fables, by books, by movies, by characters, by warnings, lessons, and they never quite happen exactly the same way, and I still don't quite understand how it works.
I love that this is how they started the interview because that is one of the most magical things about writing. If you don't know, I'm a writer too. I don't write songs, but I write other stuff. And the best thing about writing is that inspiration, best and worst thing, is that inspiration can come from wherever, whenever, and you can't predict it and you can't replicate it. You literally can't strike lightning in a bottle twice. Even if you do something better than something that you did before, it's not the same. It can never be the same. And her completely cavernous imagination and her ability to be inspired by so many things, as she like lays out very clearly here, is such a positive indicator that she has just the writer's eye. Being a writer is to like live your life in observance of the things that go on around you. And that is what makes Taylor such a sensational songwriter. The fact that she has her eyes open, and no matter what happens to her, how jaded she gets, what experiences she has, she will still always be waiting for that lightning bolt to strike her. And that feeling is completely irreplaceable. And it feels different every time. And I love that she's starting by articulating that.
There's an attention to detail when you are
like so pretty.
17 to 22 years old and you're longing, mm-hmm. or you're reaching and grasping but never holding someone's attention or someone's love or someone's dedication, and you're just, you can't understand why. You spend all day thinking about it. You notice everything. You notice candle ash on the cuff of the shirt and the button.
This is Taylor Swift.
It's everything that makes
Goosebumps.
The mythology of those intense feelings that you have. And I've always tried to, like, without being a completely unhinged adult, keep that level of detail and intensity when it comes to trying to describe a feeling.
Okay, so I'm immediately encountering an interesting problem. And I don't want this to be the showgirl bashing video because that is simply not what I'm trying to do. I just think that Taylor's at a very interesting creative juncture in her career specifically. What she's talking about here, that specificity of feeling, that ability to translate something very obsessive and yearning and longing, and she's tying it to being young here as well. What first caught her attention and drew her to writing songs was to try and translate these obsessive longings and feelings that she had. That specific skill and propulsion as a writer is what I really think Life of a Showgirl lacks. They're, the good things that you can say about the life of a showgirl really are kind of more about the feeling, the production, the sentiment of happiness kind of bubbling over in it. But that specificity, that detail, that attention to the very micro movements in the world that can describe or stand in a as placeholders for how you feel, that is really not at play on Life of a Showgirl. I really only see it very fleetingly on a song like Ruin the Friendship. So that's an interesting morsel. Let's keep going.
I think the first songs that I like fell in love good with tonight, was the girls. Type of songwriting that I think folk and country is really kind of known for. It's like that story time structure. Songs like Harper Valley PTA or Goodbye Earl by the Dixie Chicks or like any amazing Kenny Chesney song where like first verse, little girl learns a lesson that in the chorus her mom teaches her about. Then the little girl grows up and now she's a teenager and she realizes, oh my God, my mom was right about this. Now the second time you hear the hook, that same hook means something a little bit different because she's like grown up in her life. Then the bridge, maybe she goes on in her life. She has a little girl. She imparts that wisdom onto her. And then if you really want to get me to cry, like bring back that same first line of the song and end the song with it. So that was the first thing that made me think.
I like to hear about how she thinks structurally. Yes!
That was the first type that I really fell in love with. But then lyricism, I was the most intensely impacted by emo music, right? Dashboard Confessional, Chris Carrabba, All Out Boys, Pete Wentz's lyrics, how they take a common phrase and then they just twist the knife of it, right? Like, I'm just a notch in your bedpost, but you're just a line in a song.
A new notch in a belt is all I'll ever be. Okay, I actually think it's so genius to hear her connect those two things together in the context of songwriting for the first time in my version of hearing it. Pete Wentz, Fall Out Boy, and the Dixie Chicks makes such perfect sense when you listen to those really early Taylor Swift records. Speak Now, for example, I think is the perfect collision of those two instincts and influences. And I also think that like a really underrated part of Taylor's early storytelling and songwriting is there was a lot of rage there. The marketing and the buzz and the press around her was that she was America's good girl, but Picture to Burn, that's her Goodbye Earl. That's a crazy song. Better Than Revenge is crazy. Tell Me Why is crazy. Forever and Always is insane. There was a lot of pent up female rage going on, I would say even more on those early records because it had to be a little bit more subtextual. That makes it feel a lot more charged and a lot more feminine as well because, you know, women are often encouraged to withhold their emotions, especially emotions like anger or frustration. And having those two influences makes so much sense to me. She gets the structure of the country songwriting. I love to hear her talking about how she likes to literally lay out a song, like the skeleton, the bones of a song, because I think it's become so natural to her that it's good to get her to articulate it so that I guess we can hear how she intuits information about the inspiration strike that she receives and then thinks about how can I bring this idea that I've had into the world and translate it in a way that makes sense for me and my abilities. To start with that very kind of rigid storytelling structure of a country song, but then to also hone in on that very like torrid expression of angst and pent up despair and emotion that emo music gets to be really melodramatic without the pretense of irony. Like it is sincere. That's the best part about it and what people find to be cringe about it as well and what makes it a very different kind of thing from rock music. And I think that both of those two genres have a level of sincerity and commitment to the bit that Taylor really has in spades as a songwriter. And I love to hear that those are two of her biggest influences because I think that it all clicks. It all makes sense.
Drop a heart, break a name. Like it's drop a name, break a heart. But they switched it and
she loves wordplay.
I'd be reading those lyrics and I'd just finish reading a line and just go, oh my God. I got a publishing deal when I was 14. I was signed by a guy named Arthur Buenahora at Sony. And he just believed that I had a perspective that mattered.
Period, as he should.
And many people actually asked him if he could please hold my songs from being pitched to other artists. I was like, just give me some time to try to get a record deal. I'm going to try so hard. Three songwriters writing in this room, three songwriters in this room, four in this room, two in this room. And I would just go to school.
The publishing deal is so glossed over.
Downtown. 30 minutes, and I would go and I'd have a songwriting session with someone that I'd never met before, but I really didn't want to I didn't want to come in unprepared, so I'd walk in with 4 to 5 nearly finished things, 2 half finished things, 10 hooks, because I just never wanted people to be like, yeah, there's this like little kid that thinks she can swan her way into Music Row.
Okay, I'm going to pause here because I want to talk about this over-preparedness, because I think that that is such an essential and overlooked skill of being a creative. Being talented, having good ideas, being charismatic, being a good performer is like 30% of the battle. 70% is the execution of an idea, of being willing to inconvenience yourself in order to prove a point, as Taylor has said, or in order to make something that you think is really valuable. It's very respectful of the people that she's working with, their time, by being prepared walking into a session with them, but it's also respectful of like her creative energy and her, it's a very practical attitude to have as a 13-year-old to walk into a room and say, okay, I know that I have an hour, I have to go home and do my homework, so here are the things that I have that I'm working on that I want you to help me fine tune. And we know that this is an approach that she's carried into all of her studio sessions since. I think we were revisiting the 73 Questions interview and she was asked about how she goes into a session with Max Martin. And she said, I want to be prepared. And I think that this also helps make her pretty much the sole author of whatever project that she's working on. Because a lot of the creative writing process, I think, in songwriting rooms, from how I've heard it relayed as of late, is the songwriters will have an idea or the producer will bring a hook and then they'll kind of work something out roughly, then bring the artist in and start workshopping from there. There are so many different ways to write a song. There isn't one correct or wrong way to do it. I just think that Taylor's is a very specific kind that is focused on authorship and narration from her personal perspective, very singularly. Taylor's approach is to walk in with all of her ideas and basically have everyone in the room. They're collaborating with her, yes, but they're working for her. She has a vision that she wants to execute. And that is what makes her a very powerful and unique artist. I mean, of course, she has the leverage now at this point in her career to walk in and say, this is how I want things to go. But see, when she was 14 years old at Nashville, she was walking into these rooms where she was no one. She was just a little kid with all of these writers. And yet she, by being overprepared, by walking in with ideas, she was taking control in the room. She was saying, okay, well, we're actually going to write what I want to write. I'm not here to come in and listen to your ideas of what it feels like to be a 14-year-old teenage girl. I know that. What I need help with is learning the structure and learning the craft of how to put all of this together. And I just think she's always had a brilliant approach to working, and that work ethic part, being prepared, coming in with an idea, being open to that idea changing, also having a bunch of backup ideas in case the first thing that you're working on maybe isn't the thing you're going to work on today. This is what makes her sessions time efficient. And also, I think this is why Taylor can produce and create so much. This is why she's so prolific, because there isn't a lot of sitting around, like shooting the wondering time going on. It's very focused. She gets the idea and the idea needs to be born into the world. And she may need some help getting it there, but she's also perfectly capable of doing it on her own. Unique.
But I think one of my favorite things about country music and the storytelling where it was when I arrived there, there was almost this tradition of sort of breaking the fourth wall, making the song then a part of the song, or the writing of the song becomes a part of the song. And I did that in a song called Tim McGraw, the song Our Song, which I still love.
She's really throwing out the bangers here.
It's all about this romance and this relationship. And then in the end, it says, I grabbed a pen and an old napkin and I wrote down Our Song. So I love
doing that.
Why
am I feeling the tears coming? Don't do it. Don't do it.
Like, edit was me.
She does love doing that. Don't make me cry. Don't play Our Song right now. Don't do that. Don't do that to me.
My favorite end plot twist that I've done in songwriting is the ending of The Last Great American Dynasty.
Oh, period.
That's my favorite one.
It's so good.
Women with madness, their men and bad habits, and then it was bought by me.
No, seriously, like, the world changed.
Every time
the world
I get to that part
changed.
When I would sing it on tour, I just like have to kind of like I wanted my grin to go from here to here, but that looks crazy. So it's like I had to like taper down my own excitement that hook happened. I learned you can't ever really tell if other people are going to like it. But oftentimes when I love it to a certain degree, I loved the Reputation album.
Same diva.
Like, you guys say what you want. I know what I did. I love it. Like, go with God. Sorry. Like, you
so
can come
true.
Around if you want. It's okay if you don't. And then, you know, 6 or 7 years later, people are like, oh my God. Like, ready for it. Like, mm-hmm. people slept on that song.
They did. You're so right, Queen. They did. They made fun of it.
When we were making that song, I just remember, like, I wanted to, like, headbang myself through a wall. I felt that when we wrote Ready For It. I felt that way during writing Getaway Car.
Oh, my God, it's so good to hear her talking about this.
I think the first time I felt like, I don't care if people hate this because I love it so much, was when I wrote the song Love Story.
Interesting.
When I was 17.
Why would you think people would hate that?
Sitting in my bedroom. Mad at my parents.
Why would anyone hate that?
A date with a guy who is too old, so I shouldn't have been on a date with him anyway.
Period.
And this is why you need to discipline your kids, because they might write songs that go number one.
Yes. I wish that we had had a little bit more information on why she felt like, oh, I guess she's not saying that she thought it would be received poorly. She was just saying that she didn't care how people received this because it felt very true and it felt good to her. No, it's crazy that she wrote Love Story in her bedroom. It's crazy. It's insane. Her favorite topic.
Yes! I was 18 and 19. And I was...
Speak Now mentioned.
Coming from this big, massive moment that I had with an album called Fearless.
It's like I know this entire story and yet I'm on the edge of my seat.
It was the first time there was like this big debate over whether I deserved to be there. There are always going to be like little debates. Do you know what I mean? But this was like headline news. I was like, these discussions can lead to a really bad place if I don't do something to counteract
clairvoyance
them to prove that, no, it wasn't my co-writers that did all this work.
And she looks so good.
Yes, I am the author of this entire body of work that I was very proud of. I'd written so many songs alone, and I love collaboration. I love co-writers, but it's not something that I needed.
So
it's,
true.
It's when I started to trust myself as an editor, that was a really important album for me in terms of becoming a writer that knew I could trust my own intuition. Mm-hmm.
Let's have a moment where we just say, speak now the diva that you are and continue to be. She is not given enough props or credit. I'm glad that Taylor has singled that album out here. Obviously, when she's giving an interview about songwriting, she has to talk about Speak Now. But Speak Now is such a massive accomplishment because not only does she tackle the challenge of writing everything on her own by herself, she also really expands the forms that her songs can take, because Fearless was full of like very neat, tidy country pop songs. And I suspect that a lot of that was due to, you know, the people that she was working with helping her translate songs into a structure like Our Song or a structure like Love Story. Speak Now was almost entirely unconcerned with following a radio formula or a template. It followed the formula that Taylor felt fit the song. And that is not a luxury that artists at that age in her industry that were that commercially successful often get to have. So the fact that she was able to do it and prove it to herself, I really think that Speak Now was, as she said, the foundational point where she really knew that she was a gifted, God-sent writer.
I have little phonetic things. I love alliterations. Mm-hmm. I love, you know, two words that start with the same letter.
Period.
Love that. I don't like to have a
word
so
interesting.
End. With the same letter that the next word starts with. For example, in the song, Our Song, it was supposed to be when you're on the phone and you talk real low. But I was like, I don't like the real low. So it
See?
Turned into when you talk real slow. Certain words just like fly.
Cadence. This is what makes Taylor Swift more than a top line songwriter. A top line songwriter is when you get a beat, you get a melody, and you come in and you just write the words, essentially. More or less, that's what it is. Taylor is interested in the way that those words move and flow musically, and she's not given enough credit for that either. She's not. This is a very small but good example, talk real low to talk real slow. It just sounds better. It rolls off your tongue. It's more catchy. That is a really important, subtle, minute tweak that really comes down to taste. It comes down to your taste, and it comes down to your ability to assess catchiness, hookiness. Diva.
I sort of love the combination of modern vernacular and sort of old world or classic timeless speak.
Okay, we know that she loves the combination of old world timeless speak and modern vernacular. Sometimes it rocks. Sometimes a red rose grew out of the ice cold ground with no one around to tweet it. Sometimes I come back stronger than a 90s trend. This is another matter of taste.
So in the song, The Fate of Ophelia, there's a lot of sort of modern terminology and speak and kind of common phrases from the way that we talk now. But there's also like in the bridge,
it,
there's a line from Hamlet that I repurpose. Take one word that's at the beginning of the phrase and then you take its opposite. Because ultimately, like, we are all filled with polarity, hypocrisy, these kind of battling features and factors that make up our jagged personalities. I have my phone and I have...
I want to take another moment to pause and talk about that, because this again is why Taylor has developed this very robust parasocial connection with her fans. She is able to translate the human experience in an artful and strategic way. She's thinking of, how can I best say this in a way that's going to resonate and relate to the people that are hearing it? She's not just thinking about, how do I want to say it or what's going to sound good? She's also imagining the intended effect that it's going to have. The audience is partially in the room with Taylor when she's writing a song, not to assess whether they like it or not, but to assess whether it's going to resonate or connect with people. And I think she's always trying to gauge, how can I get the most amount of people to resonate with this as possible while still also translating an experience that is very personal and unique to me? She thinks about it. She thinks about these things.
This file where I'll just be like, I know I like that, or I know I like that word, or I know I like that question. And then when I'll go into a session, I don't have social media on my phone. Like, it looks like I'm just endlessly scrolling, but I'm scrolling through the words in my file. If we're in the middle of writing a song, I'm searching for a perfect line that I thought of 4 years ago at 3 a.m.
Period. Okay, so we come back to being prepared. We come back to preparedness. And also we come back to a writer's life, because you're not just a songwriter or a writer when you step into a session. You're not just a writer when you sit down to write on a piece of paper or open a Google Doc. You are a writer all the time. And part of becoming a writer, something I learned in college, is learning how to incorporate your writer's eye into your everyday life. It requires a discipline and a focus and a commitment that goes beyond just writing, just doing the thing, being observant, noticing things, collecting words that you like, collecting phrases that don't fit here, but maybe might fit there somewhere along down the road. This is very good practical and technical advice. A professor of mine would have called it keeping a notebook. And that is, I think, the best way to do it really is to physically transcribe what you're writing. It lodges it in your brain in a very specific way. But Taylor's a busy girl. She's on the go. And also, writing something down, you can lose it. So having it in your phone, whatever. It doesn't matter how you write it down. But just getting enough down. Joan Didion, one of my favorite quotes from her, is, it's so simple. See enough, write it down. That's what you do.
I think the importance for me of a bridge, it just feels like we're painting a picture, we're setting a scene.
Lost art.
We have this opportunity as a songwriter to tell an entire story, an entire movie, or a very detailed description of one scene in a movie, or a very nuanced dynamic between people, or a complicated emotion. And we have only so long to do this, you know? Mm-hmm. The bridge can be where you zoom back, you walk 20 feet back, and you see what this entire painting was supposed to be.
This is where the song can change.
You've seen brush strokes, you've seen the color tones, but the bridge can be when you step back and you feel everything that that piece of art was supposed to make you
feel.
The climax. That's just how I feel about bridges. I came up as a songwriter in Nashville where structure is a huge part of how you effectively tell a story. That's something that I absolutely subscribe to, that idea that it's, you know, structure is important. But I think that when you write enough songs, and at least in my case, the intuitive
God, she's saying
part
some genius
of your songwriting
stuff here right
brain
now.
Can kind of create a new structure that's not as classically what you've been taught. Like, Jack Antonoff is a collaborator of mine and one of my best friends. We established this thing that we love to do, and we call it the rant bridge.
Okay, I have to pause because I'm going to lose my thoughts if I don't stop and talk. Taylor is, again, giving very good and essential writerly advice for anyone, any kind of writer, not a songwriter necessarily. You need to be able to master a form before you learn how to fuck with it and play with it. This is what a poetry professor of mine told. She said, you cannot start writing modern contemporary poetry and be completely ignorant of iambic pentameter or like structures and forms of poetry, lyricism that existed in the past. Taylor became a master of her specific kind of songwriting craft, this very specific structural songwriting moment that she's talking about here. And by becoming a master of that, she learned its full potential and the scope of what it can do, the capability that can be held in that specific period of time, but she also learned what you can't achieve in that period of time. And having parameters on your creativity is actually really helpful because it forces you to be more inspired and to really fixate on and drill down to the best parts of an idea. So I think that, you know, Taylor really was focused and committed to that song structure over and over again before she really started playing with what the structure of a song could sound like, shorter songs, songs that maybe weren't always building up to the bridge, songs that weren't so formulaic. That was an early critique of her work that I think is makes so much more sense now in hindsight. Like, it wasn't formulaic in a pejorative sense. It was formulaic because she was learning how to do it properly. And once she mastered it, she can return to it at any point. And she does frequently. She returns to the structure all the time. But what happens when you master it is that then you can play because you understand the constraints of what you're working with. You respect the form. You know what it can and can't do. That's when you can get a little silly with it. But before you can get silly with it, you have got to learn how it works. You have to understand what it can do. And you have to subscribe a little bit at least to a mission of what a song is able to do, especially if you want to do storytelling, diaristic, confessional pop songwriting, which is what basically every pop songwriter wants to do these days, is make you invested in the songwriter's personal story so that you want to hear more of their music and buy it. And where people skip a lot of steps, I think, is not being devoted to learning the form. Walking into a room with songwriters, letting them come up with all of these different flows and structures and just inserting your two cents here and there or adding a line or trying to be really creative and different with every single thing that you do, those things can end up isolating you creatively. And they also make you feel a bit like adrift. You have to have a North Star as a creative, like the idea of something perfect that you're working towards. You can stray away from it, you can go behind it, in front of it, beside it. But if you don't have that idea of perfection or of a goal realized in front of you, you're never gonna get at something good. And the idea, of course, is that like perfection doesn't exist. You're always striving for it. You never reach it and you have to be okay with that. But I think that what Taylor's saying here, if I can interpret what she's saying, is that you have to understand the form and the structure and the purpose of it before you're able to play with it. And this is where the TikTok song structure really shows its because what Taylor describes here, that ability for the bridge to zoom 20 feet out and to completely change your experience of a song, that art is totally lost in the 2-minute song, completely lost. And that's unfortunate. We need to send everybody back to school. Let's go back to 3.5-minute songs.
I could point to examples like Out of the Woods, Is It Over Now, Cruel Summer. And oftentimes we
rant
love
bridge.
These rant bridges where it's basically like stream of consciousness, endless
this
pouring out
This is Gracie Abrams
emotion,
on That's So True.
Intrusive thoughts, like blended with metaphor, with discussion, with shouting. Like you want this
Hits
rant
different.
Bridge to feel the most intense of what that feeling is that you're trying to establish over the course of the song. The Mirror Ball
Bridge. Fuck my life hours.
This was Jack sending me a track during COVID.
Mirror Ball.
And me immediately knowing that it needed to be about how I felt as a performer and an entertainer within this moment
when
where
the lights go off
and art has effectively shut down. I've really begun to realize that you are a mirror. Like, you are a mirror.
I've been saying this about Taylor for years.
Your fans, for the media, for people on the internet, for just random, just people who don't even really care about your music, but they know who you are. However they feel about themselves and their life will be projected onto how they perceive you. I've never been a natural. All I do is try. You say that at first, and I remember writing that and being like, oh my God, this feels like, do you want to say this? And I'm like, actually, I feel like a lot of people feel that way. That always overrides my discomfort with if a line feels too true, because I don't really think that there's anything that's too true.
That is so great to hear and a great positive sign for where the songwriting of Taylor Swift is going in the future, to hear that she won't censor herself if she believes that a line is relatable or can be felt by multiple people. There are so many things that I want to talk about here. I need to collect my thoughts. Okay, so we were talking about Mirror Ball. She was talking about how when you are an artist in the public eye, you reflect people back to themselves, but also you are trying. You are trying to win their affection. And something I think Taylor is really good at is keeping a part of herself just for her. And a song like I Hate It Here really strikes me as a companion and important sister song to Mirror Ball, because I Hate It Here is about a place in her mind that only she has the key to that she can access. This is her creativity. This is the songwriting that she's talking us through. She can explain it. She can tell us how she does it, but we can never go there with her. We can never do it with her. No one can ever access that space. Only she is the person that is able to go there. And it is a refuge from when the world gets too hard, from when being a mirror and having people project onto you becomes too difficult. Sometimes when you write about yourself, when you are your own muse, when your own emotions are your own muse, that can veer into being a little myopic. It can veer into, this is my story and it must be shared with little self-awareness. Taylor's very best songs resonate with people because they are about an experience that she had that she recognizes is universal and she wants to share because she believes that there's an artistic merit in expressing the way that people have felt for centuries. There are only so many feelings in this world, right? The challenge is how do you articulate everything that's already been felt in your own specific and unique way? And that challenge is the driver behind what Taylor does. It's the source of her inspiration. And when she's really attuned to accomplishing that goal and that mission is when a song like Mirrorball comes in and just blows everything else out of the water. When I bring this back to the life of a showgirl, there isn't that sense of curiosity about other people's feelings. It's very much, it reminds me of Lover in the sense that it's like a throat clearing. It's a declarative thing. She's saying, I'm happy now. I want to move on from that torture poet stuff. It's a bit of a palate cleanser and a reset. It's not designed really to illustrate the human experience or to talk about the human condition, because even the experiences that she talks about on The Life of a Showgirl, falling in love, being happy, she has expressed those feelings before in more interesting and complicated, developed and relatable ways. The Life of a Showgirl is a palate cleanser, refresh, reset as you're going into this new era of your life, marrying your man, moving on to greener pastures. I accept that, but you will never catch me saying that The Life of a Showgirl has good writing. She's explaining here why it's not.
The whole thing with All Too Well was that this was a very emotional rant that I did in like a sound check. We were rehearsing for the Speak Now
story.
Tour. I was very sad. And it just became this thing where I just started rambling. And this thing went on for a really, really long time. It was like more than 10 minutes that this rambling rant
20-minute version
went on. And it wasn't cohesive and it wasn't really that structured. There are some really angry, scathing parts that I was like, kind of going to have to make this into a song that's a little bit more palatable, because I already felt so like raw putting that song out as detailed as it was.
Right.
So then it goes out into the world. It didn't make a lot of noise, that song.
It did with me.
For the first
went number
six
one in my house.
Year, but then the fans just did a thing that they've done a few times.
We ride.
Where this song just keeps bubbling up. They did this with Cruel Summer too. Mm-hmm. Where they're just like, no, we like it. We don't care if a label wants to put it out. We love this one. For years, the fans were like, give us the 10-minute version. Give us the 10-minute version.
Harassment and bullying works.
And I was like going back through diaries and finding like little fragments of it. And I didn't have the like old thing anymore. So I was looking through safes, trying to find the CD, but I had to go back and piece together lyrics and stuff. But that was the most—
Can I say, Swiftologist vindicated. I got absolutely ragged. I got dragged over the coals for saying this at the time when All Too Well 10 came out. You can tell from the way that it's constructed that it was never a thing that came out as a finished project. That was my whole thing. I always said that All Too Well was a Frankensteined song. There was no way that was the original version, which also leaves a lot of space for my interpretation that there was some editing done, that it's not exactly a historical document. There are things in that song that sound like things 18, 19, 20-year-old Taylor would not say. There are little tweaks and revisions. I'm not against that, but I am against all the fucking Swifties that came after me for saying that this was how it was created. I think this is the first time that she's actually confirmed that she never found the long thing and that it never existed as a continuous thing to begin with. It was literally fragments. We knew that. She'd said that before. But this new part about having to go back in and reconstruct it, That's new. That doesn't make it any less of an incredible creative exercise. One of my favorite parts about the Taylor's Version project is that it's an excavation of the old times updated through Taylor's current lens. That's what makes the nostalgia of it so perfect. Not that it's photorealistic and exactly identical to what it was before, but that it's filtered through this mature acceptance and understanding and reunification with something that she hasn't thought about in a while.
Everyone's bringing ideas. Everyone's chiming in. I always apply the rule, may the best idea win. I don't care if it's a good creative, you or me. If it's better, that's what goes in the song. Mm-hmm. And I do kind of like it when people challenge me on something, because I never want to be in the room with creators who are afraid that if they have a better idea, like they can't argue with me, because it must be my idea that makes it through. I'm never going to grow that way.
That's very interesting. This is the approach that I have always thought she had and wanted her to have, but I think it has really become clear that that's probably not the case as of right now. Although perhaps what it is instead is that the creative collaboration with the people that she's worked with for a long time has become so symbiotic and familiar and cozy that there isn't a lot of challenging going on, even in situations where Taylor is being challenged by the people around her. I think the real challenge would be to try and foster new creative relations with people instead of retreading paths that have gone down before. But when I think about the Max Martin stuff on Showgirl, we know from what Taylor has revealed over the years that the 1989 writing sessions were more challenging than what Showgirl was. She made it a big point to say that Showgirl was Max Martin, Shellback, and her all coming together as equals. That really implies that the first time that they collaborated, they were not meeting as equals. Max was meeting them as master of pop music. Taylor was meeting them as master of songwriting. And they found somewhere in the middle to collaborate. And The Life of a Showgirl lacks that precision clarity that Max Martin often brings to a project, which makes me think that Taylor is exerting more control and is not always taking ideas, but perhaps Max wasn't challenging her, or perhaps Max just agreed. It's not that his grip has changed or that he is not good at what he does anymore. I think the moment has kind of moved on, but there's a lot more precision in his production work and his co-writing work on an album like Eternal Sunshine than there is on The Life of a Showgirl. And the common denominator in that is Taylor, because the same issues that exist on The Life of a Showgirl also existed on Tortured Poets, also existed on Midnights. It actually started, this issue started with Folklore, and it wasn't an issue then, but it grew and grew and grew, and it was this unwieldy, dogmatic approach to saying whatever and putting it out immediately. It was the lack of edit, the lack of not even necessarily challenge, but the lack of focus and of space and time away from the project in order to figure out what was good, to develop the taste about the project. I don't know. That problem that The Life of a Showgirl has exists prior to the album.
Conversations are much more healthy now around, there's a difference between art and like going and ranting on an Instagram live. Like there's a difference. This is a song. This takes mm-hmm. craft. This takes skill. This takes expertise. But I also am really excited that like I'm a massive Somber fan of his songwriting, and his lyrics are so intensely confessional. I don't like want another man's child to have the eyes of the girl I can't forget. Are you kidding me? Like having a male artist say stuff like that is really good for the cause of women to be able to say stuff. If there's any way we can make confessional songwriting a little bit more of something that isn't like people take that as sort of like you were being messy mm-hmm. or whatever.
Okay, I'm going to ignore the somber stuff.
You have to be fair to everyone then. Are rap beefs messy?
They are.
Or are they confessional? Like we've got to just like, let's make it a music conversation rather than just like ganging up on the female artists. And I think the more male artists that are messy or emotionally complex or confessional or upset,
they don't have the sauce. That's their
happier
problem.
I am.
Okay, Somber being her like North Star of contemporary modern songwriting, someone who will write a verse and a hook and put it out on TikTok, and then depending on how people respond to it, decide whether the song is worth continuing or not. That feels very at odds with her focus on expertise and structure and history and devotion to feeling and to expressing the human experience. I guess she's just admiring someone else's songwriting skills. But Somber is not all that as a songwriter, I have to say. Moving on.
For the Folklore album and everything like that, it was really, it wasn't as a response to having a public life and the intrusions that come with that. It was really more of just wanting to challenge myself as a writer. I really have always just thought it would be so amazing to write books. And
can I take a moment and pause here? I think that's really interesting. Folklore is when I started talking about the composite sketch a lot. The idea that a song can be both born from real life and fiction, and it comes out as this kind of like messy, beautiful muddle of the two. And I think what's exciting about it is that it has that subtext of, it's almost like a dream. Like when you tell someone your dream, a lot of the stuff that happened to it, psychoanalysis, that happened in the dream is not real. Like I went to the swimming pool and this giant tooth was chasing me and blah, 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 blah. Then you unpack the dream with your analyst and you're talking about, well, it was actually my aunt's tooth that followed me into the pool and chased me. And you start to realize, even though you weren't conscious of creating the dream with an influence from the real world coming in and trying to tell you something, it was still there. And that is how I view folklore in Evermore. I think she would agree. I think she would agree. But I see what she's saying in that it was not a response to public life. And a very common refrain about folklore in Evermore has been, she was trying to hide stuff about Maddie. That is such a reductive and oversimplification way to describe what she was doing on folklore in Evermore. It was so much more than that. It was translating dreams into reality at a period of time when life felt distinctly unreal, when it felt like we were living in a bad dream that we couldn't wake up from. I think that people get confused because the subject matter of her songs is about confessions and the human experience and her emotions and how they relate to other people. It just so happens that she's very famous and the people that she's writing about are very famous. But when Taylor is creating, her goal is to advance her songwriting. Folklore and Evermore are mere projects in a larger goal and narrative that she is creating in this arc, in this legacy, in this body of work. People really get overly fixated on like who things are about, what they are about. And it's fun to guess and to try and think up these things. But I refer back to the dream analogy. This is working on a different level than just, ooh, I don't want to say that I hate my boyfriend right now. I'm going to make up stories. That really reduces the craft part of what made Folklore and Evermore some of her best and most interesting and varied works. It was Taylor taking on a new creative challenge as a songwriter.
It was really amazing. When it opened up my world, I don't think my songwriting has ever been the same after Folklore.
No,
I have always had a little bit of
permanently changed
that sort of character play in my songwriting sense. And I hope it never goes anywhere because it's really fun. I kind of like being a narrator that's not the person I relate to. So the narrator in Clara Bow is either a studio, like a Hollywood studio person or a label executive who's sitting in my mind behind a desk and meeting with a brand new starlet who's just come to town.
And giving her the advice.
The exec says, you look like Clara Bow in this light. You're so special. You're amazing. We're going to make you just like her. In my mind, that girl was Stevie Nicks. So Stevie Nicks sits down. Mm-hmm. They tell her she looks like Clara Bow.
It was someone else too, but we don't have to get into that.
And we're going to make you just like her. The second verse says, you look like Stevie Nicks in this light, the hair and lips. So in my mind, that was me that sat down opposite that desk, right? I sit down at a record label and they're like, you look like Stevie Nicks.
You can't not say it now.
Basically, you learn that like you're in this machine and they're trying to make you into a woman that they just idealized and then discarded. Like the entertainment industry love bombs women, right? We love you. We don't know who you are. Why are you even here? And so in the last verse, in my mind, it's a new artist that sits down across from a record label desk.
What's that new artist's name called?
In this light, we're loving it. You've got edge she never did. You're like this person that we like, they name a big name and they're like, oh, but you're going to be so much better. It's going to be so, no, it's going to be cooler. You're so much better. On Red, there was a song that I wrote alone in a hotel room when I was 22 years old called Nothing New.
She's firing on all cylinders here.
It sounds ridiculous, but at 22 years old, I felt completely washed up. I felt like maybe the only thing that made me special was that I was this like teen phenom, whatever I was. Like love can be so quickly handed to you and then taken away. And it's this kind of strange thing with fame. And that was the first time I ever grappled with that. Somebody was like, oh, you're 22.
Interesting.
Years
that came
old,
up twice in this interview.
Like, are you tired of me? If you're not yet, are you going to get tired of me? Because it's usually something that you would sing about later in life, but the entertainment industry, I'll tell you, there's 10 years for every year you're in it.
It's true.
But it's fun.
That is so interesting. I can't imagine the quandary that she found herself in after Speak Now and before Red. When I think of Nothing New, I really picture her with the red bangs when she was finishing off the Speak Now tour. And that, when you see all those photos of Taylor with like her new era hair in the old era's outfits, it always looks strange. That one feels especially strange to me because the growth experience between Speak Now and Red, like that was when she became a woman. That's when she grew up. That's when Give Me Back My Girlhood, It Was Mine First. It was really that like period of time where she had to develop a sense of self that was not attached to being an ingenue or a phenomenon or America's good girl, even though those were all identities, roles, and pressures and responsibilities that were placed on her at that time. I think her peers, the people that she had been in community and conversation with up until then, were Miley Cyrus and Selena Gomez and Demi Lovato, like all of these young Disney starlets who were starting to burn out, who were starting to be seen as passe or starting to not be seen as viable artists as they grew up and stopped being just for teens. And I think that Taylor had a real moment of, are the gatekeepers of this industry, the people that decide what is good, not the people who decide what is popular, are they ever going to let me in? Are they ever going to see how hard I'm trying? Are they ever going to understand just how badly I want this and how I work and study and practice and give so much focus and attention? The great trick of Taylor's career that I think she has said she's regretted a couple of times is how easy she makes everything look, how she obfuscates the fact that she sits behind a boardroom table three times a week and talks about not only what these songs are going to be, but how they're going to go out into the world, what's going to be the single, what are the marketing materials going to be. There is so much expertise that was going into what Taylor was doing, even then, from the very beginning. I think she really had a moment between Speak Now and Red where she did this whole album, where she wrote it all by herself, and she was still being branded as like a teen pop star. I think she probably felt like, well, what else do I have to do? Do I have to do a backflip? And interestingly, she came up with an answer. And the answer was, I need to become more famous. I need to become such a commercial force that the critics will have to respect me. They will have to take a look at what I do because what I do is so important to people that actually listen to music and enjoy and consume it as fans. And then she decided to go pop. That's where We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together, I Knew Your Trouble, and 22 came from. That was such a calibrated shift. She realized that she had to reach a wider audience than just her core fan base, which is really who Speak Now was appealing to. No radio hits, didn't really travel as far as Fearless, certainly didn't have any like very strong radio contenders. She realized then, okay, well, I want to keep doing what I did on Speak Now, but I also want to be the most famous person in the world because I want to have the power to turn around and say, you will take my work seriously because I try hard and I am good at it and I deserve to be recognized for it. She's a genius. She's a genius.
There's corners of my fan base who are going to take things to a really extreme place. There's nothing I can do about that. There's people who are going to try to,
oh, this is what people were saying was about me.
Do detective work, figure out the details. Who is that about? What is this? When it gets a little bit weird for me is when people act like it's sort of like a paternity test. Mm-hmm. Like, this song's about that person. Because I'm like, that dude didn't write the song I did.
Period.
But that's part of it. You have to hold tight to your perception of your art and your relationship with it. And then you just kind of have to like, there it goes. Hope you like it. If you don't now, hope you do in 5 years. And it like, and if you never do, then I was doing it for me anyway.
Interesting. Okay, so I think I'm trying to figure out what part people think applies to me here. I guess the paternity testing, but what you have to understand, and this is mostly new Swifties who won't understand this, is that she very much encouraged that. That was in the liner notes of her songs. She would put clues in the album liner notes to direct us to who the songs were about. She very much uses songwriting as a tool to right wrongs in her life, and she does this outside of romantic interests. It serves a purpose, it always has. And I think that her ability to direct us towards stuff has disappeared in the last couple of years, meaning that it's just gotten so big, she can't even direct people in the right direction anymore, so she stopped trying. But you can't really say that paternity testing is not an inherent part of what her songwriting does when it goes out into the world, because for a long time, she actively encouraged it. She wanted people to do it. It also is an essential, critical marketing skill. It's something that really makes her albums pop culture moments. It creates these, like the Maddie Healy reveal, all of that stuff. That serves mostly to support the proliferation of the art. It makes it more popular. It makes people more interested in it. I agree that it gets taken to a crazy place. Who I think she's talking to here are the Gaylers, are the people who are saying, Taylor and Maddie are still meant to be together forever and her and Travis are fake. The people who were calling her relationship a beard. That's who she's talking to. The paternity testing thing, sure, I can understand. Maybe she doesn't like that anymore. But when I'm trying to do like, who is this song about? I'm not really trying to say that it's good or bad because it's inspired by this or that person. I'm just trying to figure out with all the context clues that we have in this entire discography, all of this Easter egging, these intertextual references that she encourages people to investigate and look through. Sometimes it's fun to put the pieces together, but there is a line. There is a line of delusion and dementedness, and it's called Gaylorism.
There are so many songs in my career that would not exist, like Blank Space, would not exist if I hadn't had people being like, here's a slideshow of all her boyfriends. Like, and then Antihero is a song that I'm so proud of still.
That's a random Easter selection.
That song doesn't exist if I don't get criticized for every aspect of my personality that people,
right.
You know, my favorite thing when I sit down with new artists or songwriters, I'm like, why are you reading your comments? Like, that's too much of
everybody's
it.
So like, punk on the internet.
You're inundating yourself with too much criticism that doesn't really have a focus. But mm-hmm. I think a little bit of it, you got to just be like, this is part of it. Like, don't make this make you stop writing or make you edit yourself or whatever. If it's an interesting point to you to kind of respond to, then that's a gift for you to be able to write something. Maybe you wouldn't have written something that day. Mm-hmm. Don't go to the like notes app and post it. Like, write about it. Right, make art about this.
Use it as creative
fuel. Don't respond
fuel.
To, like, trolls in your comments. That's not what we want.
I need
from
to take
you,
that note. Face card never declines. Oh, my God. Wow. What a journey. We've learned so much. Lots of confirmations and things we already knew, but nice to hear it all strung together in a coherent, thoughtful narrative like that. Very inspiring. I'm not worried about Taylor Swift's ability to write good songs. I'm not worried. Taylor Swift, greatest living songwriter ever made. It's a list of 30, but she should be number one. Thank you so much for watching this video. Don't forget to get tickets to my tour, The Showgirl Experience, evolutionofsnake.com. It starts literally in 2 days after you're seeing this. That's crazy. And we're eating good.